So that's the first thing. I'll talk more about them. And then we're going to talk about Church Science Theories. And then General Relativity. And the idea is going to be to talk about different Lagrangians for general relativity. Okay. Good. So, questions, anything? Comments, questions? Okay. We have not so many of the older guys. That's good. So, the last time we were talking about BF theory, and in particular, we were talking about a theory in three dimensions. So we had a three manifold, sigma, and I'm going to specialize today to the case where that's a two-dimensional torus times R. Before we just had some two-dimensional compact manifold. And we have an SU2 gauge field. And we also have another one form, E, which is another SU2 value one form. Both of these are forms. This is just review, but I want to make sure that we know everything. There is the curvature, FABI is DA, ABI plus epsilon IJK, AI, A right wedge. There are many ways to write this. I'm using this mixed index notation. Actually, most people would write that wedge to one form, which is a two form AB. And we were studying the theory defined by the action, which is the integral over this, sorry, last time I called this M, or three manifold. We formed the wedge product of EI wedge F of A, and that was our action. Okay. And okay, am I right? This is what we did last time. Yes. What? Oh, JK. Thank you. Good. Okay. And we found here that when we were done, I won't repeat the whole phase space description, but we found when we were done that there was a canonical momenta high AI, which was, that's right, we had an index problem. And I've already hit the same index problem. Sorry, apologies. So I, capital IJK, were SU2 indices, and I and A012 were space-time indices, and 1 and 2 were also called I sometimes. And so then we had pi I with epsilon ij eji was the canonical momenta for the A. So the Poisson brackets were A II of X. Sorry. Pi j capital J of Y of delta 2 x, y, so this is a y, delta ij, delta ij. Now, equivalently, we can write a Poisson bracket. Since pi is e, I'm free to keep, and they each have the same number of degrees of freedom, 2 times 3, which is 6, or 2 times 3, 6. So these are the spatial components of these one forms e. So I also can just keep the theory in terms of the e's rather than the pi's, in which case you use an epsilon to go from the pi's to the e's. Let me make that explicit. This is the first time I do something like that. The inverse of that says that epsilon I is equal to lower epsilon ij, pi j I. And epsilon lower ij is the same as epsilon upper ij, which is it's a tensor equal to that, the anti-symmetric tensor in two dimensions. And so using that, this is epsilon ij delta capital ij in the SU2 indices, delta 2, x and y. And people use both, so I'm indicating both. And then we found that there were 6 constraints. Somebody's word answer. There were constraints that were called GI, which is del I capital I equals 0. I'm just reviewing. I'm reviewing stuff from last time. And there were constraints that were F I equals 0. And we noted this is the ordinary Gauss's law. These tell us that the curvature is equal to 0. I could put ij here, but there's only one choice, which is 1, 2. And so there are 3 of these and 3 of these. And these, under Poisson brackets, form the algebra of SU2. So gi, and this is at a point. So I'm going to, there's an elegant way to say to deal with algebras of constraints which are local. So it's convenient to integrate g d2x on our 2 manifold, which is the torus here, gi of x against some function, let's call it rho I of x on the manifold. Notice g is, I didn't emphasize it this time, but canonic momenta to undensitized fields are always densities, and so you can always integrate a single density. So this makes sense. And let's just define this g of rho. And it's just a nice thing to do when you're dealing with constraint algebras. And then you can check, let's say g of rho, Poisson bracket g of, I don't know, mu, is g of the function, which is epsilon ij, epsilon capital ijk, rho j mu k. Or you might just write that as rho cos mu. So the G's close. And I think it's a good exercise to check this. And if you do so, you'll see several times when we talked about Poisson brackets with fields, you have to integrate by parts cleverly. And it's a good thing to do to check that you can do this and make this happen honestly. As there's 2 integrals here. And there's a delta function in the commutator, and it goes away nicely and becomes something with 1 integral. And let me just warn you, why it's good to be careful about checking these things is that there are similar calculations quantum mechanically when, in addition, you have to worry about issues of operator ordering quantum mechanically, as well as singularities coming for divergence coming from operator products. And you have to worry that things can go wrong quantum mechanically. That is, there will be operator versions of these constraints, and we'll be interested in the operator analog of the commutation relations, and there are things that can go wrong. There can be algebras that work classically and don't work quantum mechanically, or develop extra terms. And it's a very important, the consistency of these theories depends on these algebras, and it's very important to be able to do those calculations right. And so I'll just warn you, we will later be looking at the quantum mechanical versions of these calculations. So similarly, we can have, say, an f of, I don't know, omega is the integral, same thing, fi of x, omega I of x. And you can also check that, let me do it this way, f of omega g of mu is f of omega cross mu. That's up to a sign. Don't trust me on the sign. And the f's commute with each other. Okay. And as I said at the end of last time, this is the algebra SU2. So it's like you have an SU2 algebra at each point of space. This tells you that the f's at each point in space transform like vectors under that SU2 algebra. And this tells you that the vectors commute. So altogether, this is as if you we have a Euclidean, a three-dimensional Euclidean algebra. Now, before I do anything else, I'm going to slightly complicate this theory and state some facts and leave some more exercises. I really think for the people who are taking the course, it's really good to check these exercises. And if you have trouble with them, ask me or ask in the next class, because it's a really good thing to do to be able to do these calculations. So. When I started writing the theory there, I'll just change it here. I had an integral over a three form, because you integrate three forms, which was a scalar under the SU2. So are there any other three forms which is scalars under the SU2 that we can imagine writing? With the A, if we want to get a scalar, we probably have to write something in terms of F. If I have two Fs, that's a four form. Remember, there's no metric to tie anything up. So if I have two Fs, that's a four form, and that's not going to help in four dimensions. So I have basically a two form, which is F, and a one form, which is E. And I want to make a three form. So I could take one F and one E, and then trace or tie up the SU2 indices. Is there anything else I can do?
Let's try DF.
The only thing I can make with DF is zero, because of the Bianchi identity. I can try three E's. So let's try, okay, let's say minus E wedge E wedge E. I have three indices, I, J, and K. What can I do with that? I can contract into epsilon, epsilon ij and k. I can put a coefficient in front of that, which I'm going to call lambda, and I can subtract it. Actually, I don't know which sign I really want, but it doesn't matter. So I can now consider that theory.
Okay. It's a cosmological constant.
Well, if this was gravity, that would be the cosmological constant.
Okay. Okay. Your epsilon symbol at the bottom should be fully anti-symmetric.
Yes.
Below that?
Yes, now I and j are two index objects, range over two indices.
Negative 1 and negative 1. Zero minus 1, zero minus 1.
You think the minus 1 should be down here? Is that your thought? Oh. This is the anti-symmetric two index object. This is the anti-symmetric three index object.
Right.
Okay. I don't trust me on science. Okay. You can trust me. All of this is in that review article. And you can, I believe, trust the science in the review article, cosmological gravity with a positive cosmological constant. At least I spent an entire evening getting all the signs consistent with each other when I wrote the article. But don't trust me off the spot with science. Okay. So one actually has another term one can write. And there actually is a third term that you can write, but we'll come to that later. Because okay, the third term is far from obvious. But I'm going to postpone that. So let's consider this. So. What changes? Okay. Well, there's still only a time derivative here, so the canonical momenta is the same. So the Poisson brackets are the same. So that takes care of everything on that board. But the constraints are different. And roughly speaking, this constraint is the variation of the action by A0. Do you remember how it came? So this is roughly the variation of the action by A0i, and that doesn't change. But this is the variation of the action by E0. Now, why do I say that it's the variation of the action by E0? I went through two steps. I had that the momentum, I forget what I called it, P, the momentum conjugate to E0, delta S, delta E dot 0, I, was 0. And then to preserve this, I had to find a new constraint, which was the Poisson bracket of this with the Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian, of course, you remember, was the pi a dots plus the p e dots minus Lagrangian. So the Poisson bracket of this with the Lagrangian, with the Hamiltonian, the only thing it can come into is the Lagrangian, the integral over which was the original action. And in the Poisson bracket, this means take the derivative with E0. So this is, if you trace it through, the same thing as the variation of the action by E0 by the thing conjugate to this. And that is the new constraint. And previously, if we just take the variation by E0, okay, so this is a three form. E0 means that here we have F12, which means we have a two form in the two-dimensional surface. So that's how we got the F. But now there's another term here. In other words, when one can write the action has the form of E0i times F ij. There's an epsilon. Let me write this out. Let me remember. There's an epsilon ij because that comes from the wedge. And it was an IJ0, but we pick out the E0. And then the thing that E0 multiplies in the action is an E0 here multiplying the F with spatial indices. So there's just an FIJ. And then there's a lambda EI wedge EJ from this term. In other words, E0, E1, E2 is what is the term that I'm interested in. And I pick up here JK times epsilon IJK. So the constraint is now, and let me, I'm going to give it a name called script F. I, it's now FI, always in the 1-2 direction, plus lambda epsilon IJK E1 wedge E2 JK. And that's the new constraint. So we just, that's the only place where something changes. We pick up a term here, proportional to lambda, except I got the sign wrong. Okay, is that clear? So now I can just change the letters here. So G is the same as before. However, now we have this script F constraint. And we have the G acting. And this is for everybody to check. We just get the script F there. And I think I said this, but I think I said this just for the abelian case. Is that right? That the G generates gauge transformations? Did I show that? I showed it for the abelian case. Did I show it for the non-abelian case? Okay. So let's just check that. So the Poisson, this is what you need to check these formulas. The Poisson bracket of AII of X times G of, what are we calling it, rho. Okay, let me just do that. So that's the integral D2Z from here, rho of Z, say J, capital J for the angles part, and then the Poisson bracket of AI capital I of X with partial I pi, let me not call that I, let me call that little k. And let me have the index J matches to there, and this is of Z. Okay, so now there's more to check because this is two terms. This is partial k pi kj of z, and this is d by dz. And then there's another term, which is epsilon I, I'm sorry, j, say lm, this is the meaning of the covariant derivative, akl pi km. Let me put those lm downstairs. And now, when I take the Poisson bracket, I have to do two things. Well, I already explained how to do it in the abelian case. In the abelian case, the derivative comes outside, then you integrate by parts. Then you have A with pi, which is delta, and you integrate, and you get something that in the end looks like minus del Let me just get my indices right. Del I, rho, capital I. So that's the first term. Okay. The second term, again, what's relevant is the A with the pi here, and is left over a delta function, an A, and a rho. Now, there's only, if there's any justice, there's only one thing that that can go into, which is plus epsilon I L M A I L rho M. In other words, minus the derivative, minus the covariant derivative del I of rho I. Okay? And I'll leave you to check that that's what happens. Because I do allow myself in the SU2 sector. I do allow myself, there is a delta that lets me raise and lower indices, because there is a metric on the SU2 group.
Okay.
Now, again, you could challenge me to be less background dependent and throw that away and work without a metric in the internal space, too. In which case, you get something called Cahill-Bell theory, and the gauge group is GLNC. And we can discuss that if sometimes somebody wants to. But I'm working with that issue. Okay. So this says that under the Poisson bracket with G, A changes by a gauge transformation. Okay. And similarly, with pi, now here, let's just look at this for a minute, just for completeness. So this is the same thing, the integral d2z rho, so let me call this I here so I can follow the same rho j of z. And here I have just pi with d pi. So the only non-zero, the only chance to get a non-zero Poisson bracket from the pi with the d pi is that sitting in the d pi there's an a. So you can pick up a term where this a and this pi have a non-zero Poisson bracket giving a delta function, and you're left over the other pi and the rho and the epsilon. So not surprisingly, when you're done integrating over the epsilon, this is the epsilon J L M rho L pi M. So this just rotates like a vector to the gauge transformations. And that's the result of G. So the nice result, I mean, here I've shown it for A and pi, but any function on the phase space is a function of the A's and the pi's, because those are the phase space coordinates. So it's true that for any function of A and pi, the Poisson bracket with G of rho is the same thing as the delta under a gauge transformation of that function of A and pi under an SU2 gauge transformation. So the G's are generating SU2 gauge transformations on the phase space. Okay. So that allows me just to come here, and this just says F is a vector as far as SU2 is concerned at each point. It's a two-form at each point of a two-manifold, so there's only one two-form at one point. And then it's a vector in SU2. And what this says is that it transforms just like a vector under SU2. Okay. Now, what about the script F with the script F? Okay. Let's, I'm not going to do the whole thing, but I'll sketch it for you. So Poisson bracket of script F, what are we calling it? Mu, oh, it has to be different things. Say rho and mu. Script F of mu. And notice that I have F there. Where's my F? Expressed in terms of the E's. Okay. Now the E's are the same thing as the pi's with epsilons. Okay. So I should express those as epsilons, but it's easier in this case just to use the Poisson bracket between the A's and the E's, which are each one forms. So it's easier to use this Poisson bracket. When you do this, it's clear that what's of interest, I mean, we have some D, sorry, 2y, say, some D2z. What's of interest is where the F term of one of these, so each of them is of the form of F minus lambda E wedge E, okay, with F minus lambda E wedge E. Okay. So it's clear that the only terms which are relevant are the terms when you have an F on one of them, an F12, say, a Y with an E1, E2 of Z. There's an I, there's a rho I, there's a LM, epsilon JLM, there's a mu J. This is of Y, this is of Z. And you have to work this out. Okay, and let me just talk you through it.
And this is the extra term.
This is the extra term.
Is that another one?
Well, normally the F with the F is zero. And the E's with the E's are zero. Okay, and there are two terms like this. So it's this minus some anti-symmetrization. Okay, let me just talk you through what has to happen. In here, there's two terms. There's a derivative of A, and there's an A squared term. Okay. The term with the derivative of the A, look at what happens. The derivative has to come outside. Then the A takes away one of the E's, leaving you a term with a derivative and an E. Okay. In the other term, the A takes away one of the E's, leaving you a term with an A and an E. Okay. So this might vanish, but if it doesn't vanish, it has the form of something like a derivative of an E, okay, and an A and an E. And then there's the rho and the mu. Okay, well, the E is like the pi, so that's like a derivative of a pi and an A and a pi multiplied times an E and a mu. Okay? So what could that be? Again, it might all vanish because there's two terms and they subtract each other. But if it doesn't vanish, what could it be? Okay. Well, which is G?
Yeah,
G. Yeah. So remember what Dirac said, you have to keep taking Poisson brackets of the constraints because these are in the Hamiltonian. I forgot to say, but should have said, that the Hamiltonian, when you work it out, is just some function of mu I fi plus rho j g j integrated over the two manifold. So for the constraints to be consistent under the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian, the constraints with themselves have to close. Okay. So the only nice possibility is that this is g of rho cross mu. Okay, and it is. So you should check that. And notice there is that lambda that nicely comes out front. Because lambda is just a number. So then what this is telling us is that this is equal to lambda times g of rho times mu. Okay? Now, what algebra is that? Depending on the sign of lambda, but for the lambda positive. Did anybody recognize that? Here's the G generates the three-dimensional rotation group. Let's not worry about the difference between SU2 and SO3. Okay? So we have three-dimensional rotations, the G, and then we have three other things that transform as vectors under three-dimensional rotations and close themselves to the three-dimensional rotations. Yeah. So now what it is SO4. It's SO4 with lambda positive with, let me give myself a little bit of room there. With lambda negative, it's SO, it's the Lorentz group, it's SO13.
It's okay. Euclidean group of the three lambda.
Yeah, well.
I mean, conformal
group. Conformal, or it's like a de Sitter. This is really, I mean, if we've Euclideanized the three dimensions, then this is like the Sitter and that. This is the Euclidean de Sitter solution, which is the four sphere, and this is its solution. This is, sorry, its symmetry. And this is the hyperboloid. Yeah. Okay. So it certainly looks like lambda has something to do with the cosmological constant. Okay. And we'll see that. Okay. Yes. You can also see it in the conformal group. There are many, they're not many, there are several different interpretations of these things, and they work together. Okay. I am very tempted to tell you about the relation of this to trend scientist theory, but I'm not going to yet. Okay. But I will by the end of today. A last question. What does evolution under this Hamiltonian mean? Now, we know that this, the G, generates global gauge transformations. And we've seen that before when we just did Maxwell theory, that as the fields are evolving, they can transform arbitrarily under gauge transformations. But what is the F doing? So what is the meaning of this Hamiltonian? Okay. Well, I will give a hint now and then we'll come back to it. The hint is, let's just look at the field equation, which I don't think I did. Is that right? So let's go back and look at the field equations. If I vary, just in the four-dimensional sense, if I vary the action by the three form, E, A, I, okay, then that's a field equation. And there's an F there, and there are E's there. So I get F minus lambda E wedge E is equal to 0. And I should put on the appropriate indices for which I need more space. JK epsilon I JK is equal to 0. So this says that the curvature or the field strength F is 0 if lambda is 0 and otherwise constrained to be related to this 2 form E wedge E. And the other field equation varying by the A, you can check this, and you should check all of these, of course, tells you that the covariant D wedge E is equal to 0. And there's no lambda there. So this tells us that the one form E's, the connection or the gauge field A is such that the one form E's appear to be covariantly constant, at least in this anti-symmetrized way, when the curvature is constrained to the E's. Now, if you pull these back to the two manifolds, so remember we have a two manifold here, sigma, which I'm going to make use of making it the two torus in a while, then these field equations are each equations about two forms. They each say that a certain two form is zero in the three-dimensional space. And if I pull these back, because I can pull back forms to submanifolds, if I pull back to the two-manifold, then this is equal to the constraints F, and this is equal to the Gauss's law. So these constraints are components of the field equations in the spatial parts. And why they're constraints is because they don't have any time derivatives. So they must hold on initial conditions. The other component, for example, the other component of this that doesn't pull back has to involve here a time derivative. So there's some, the one who doesn't pull back has some time derivative here. So the one that doesn't pull back says something like A dot I minus covariant derivative, let's give this an index I, del I A0 I minus lambda E0 wedge EI JK epsilon I JK equals 0. So this is a field equation. It tells us how the A's evolve in time. And similarly, in here, there's a field equation that tells us that E dot, that's the D0 there, I plus, I just have to covariantize that, I epsilon I JK A0 JEIK is equal to 0. So those are the field equations. We have the constraints, and then we have fields that we have equations that tell us how the A evolves in time, and this is the spatial part of the A, and how the spatial part of the E evolves in time. Remember, the time part of A, the A0 is just a Lagrange multiplier. It doesn't, there's no time derivatives on it, as in the spatial part of the E. So any idea what we should do with those field equations? In the Hamiltonian theory. But I should get the field equations by taking Poisson brackets with the Hamiltonian. Right? So I should, to understand those, let me go over there. I should compute the Poisson brackets. And so let's just check one. A dot I, capital I, at a point C of the manifold is the Poisson bracket of AII with the Hamiltonian. And I'm sorry, we have to peer way over the board there, the Hamiltonian. So we know what this term is going to do. This term makes a gauge transformation. So let's think about this term. So this term, so there's an integral, did I call that mu? V to y, mu of y, say, k. And the f has just in it, as before, the f and the term with the two e's. So the only term that comes in that means anything, right, so I have the Poisson bracket of a, I, of z, I. The only term that can come in is the term with the two e's. So this is a function of x, this is a function, I'm sorry, of y, this is a function of y. And let me see how precisely we have to do this. Let me say L, M, epsilon, K, L, M. And what's going to happen is we pick off one E. I won't do this for signs or factors, but just to get the basic thing. We pick up one, the A goes away with one E, and we're left with an E. So this is going to give us something like, and the we're left with an epsilon, the A makes the I the same thing as L, which goes here. So this is something like epsilon K I M mu K at the point Z, and finally E M at the point Z after we integrate over the delta function. And then there's another term which is under the gauge transformation part. So we get the gauge transformation part is D of rho, DI of rho capital I. So let's compare that, and here there's an I here. So let's compare that to the equations of motion. This is a gauge transformation. So this looks just like this. So comparing them, we see that rho k is just like k0k, so the Lagrange multiplier. And this term is something epsilon ei, and this is also something epsilon ei. So what we learn is that mu k is actually just e0k. And I forgot that there's a lambda here because this is from the E wedge E term. So the lambdas are right. Okay. So basically what we learn is that this is like A0 and this is like E0. So that's starting to be a hint of what to think about what this is doing. Okay. Okay. There's more we can get from this. And I did tell you last time that this is secretly gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions, but I'm not using that yet. And I will be deriving that. Let's talk about observables. And by an observable, I want some function of the A's and the E's, spatial guys. Remember, the E spatial are as good as the pi, so I use them interchangeably. They're just the same thing, which has the property that it's gauge invariant, so it commutes with G mu. And it also, if it's an observable, if it's to be a function of constrained data, remember the idea is that there's a constraint. Here's the phase space, gamma, of all the A's and all the pi's, and there's some constrained surface in here. The constrained surface is G equals 0, and the script F equals 0. So an observable, if it's to be a function on the constraint surface, should also commute with the constraints. So this should also, the O should also commute with the F. And from now on, I probably often use this notation where I use the integrated form of the constraints. So saying that the constraints are labeled by a function is the same thing as saying we have so many constraints per point. But it's just easier from the point of view of computation. So we want to find some such observables. And I'm going to be a sissy and consider first the case of lambda equals 0. Because it's harder. It's definitely harder if I don't do that. Yeah, although it's completely solved, but there's a trick that's useful to state. I mean, we could do it, but it'll make the calculations a little bit more complicated. So let me just talk about observables with zero, quote, cosmological constant. Well, under zero cosmological constant, then the evolution of A is just a gauge transformation under both the G's and the F's. And this is related to something, remember, let me remind you, last time I argued that a diffeomorphism by a vector field B acting on a one form was the same thing as a gauge transformation under V into A well, in this case, of A, plus a term in V and F. And this is still true when we have a non-abelian case. So when F is 0, the effect of a gauge transformation is the same as a diffeomorphism. So both G and F are generating gauge transformations, but we can't tell the difference between who's a gauge transformation and who's a diffeomorphism when F is 0. So that's why it's a little bit simpler to take lambda equals 0 right away. So what that means is if I have a function of, and actually the same is true for E, for little e. So if I have a function of A in E, which is ordinarily gauge invariant, then it will have vanishing Poisson brackets with both constraints. So I just have to construct some functions that are ordinarily gauge invariant and are meaningful subject to the constraints. Because I can't write F because F is 0. Okay. So we discussed this before. We had the same dilemma when we were talking about abelian transcendence theory, and I wrote the integral of A around a closed curve. Now it's a little bit more intricate because A is not just a one form, it lives in SV2. And so I have to introduce a non-abelian version of integrating on a curve. And I want to get an object which behaves nicely under gauge transformations. So many of you know this, but not everybody. So the people who don't know this, please bear with us for 5 minutes. And I'm going to introduce the notion of a path-ordered integral. Path-ordered line integral. And the idea is the following. Given a path gamma from a point P to a point Q, so P is like gamma of 0 and Q is like gamma of 1, and gamma is a function of a parameter S that runs from 0 to 1 along the curve.
What do you mean by that? Is gamma a
I mean the variation under a gauge transformation where this is the gauge function. So in this case, D, I have my indices sort of wrong. This should be a B and this should be a B. I mean del B of the contraction of B and A in this case. Okay? So if I have an abelian connection, as we said before, I can just integrate integral of gamma of A. And that's gauge invariant for a closed curve. But it's a mess now because the transformation of A has this extra term. The gauge transformation of A, delta A, I'm doing this on a general manifold. AI is now the covariant derivative of some function lambda I, which means there's the ordinary derivative, and then there's the extra term, epsilon ijk, AA, j, lambda, k. And because of this extra term, just the integral over A is not, doesn't have any, even if A is a closed curve, doesn't transform nicely. What turns out to transform nicely is a construction called the path-ordered integral, and it's called also the holonomy along the curve. It's a function of A, and it's written formally, and then I'm going to define this as a mysterious symbol P times the exponential of the integral over the curve of A. Now, why this mysterious symbol is needed is that this A is a matrix. It lives in the 2x2 Hermitian matrices. So if I write this out in gory detail, this object here is the exponential of the integral ds gamma dot A of S AA of gamma of S times I times the Pauli matrices, sigma I. And the question is, how do I define the exponential of this matrix? And can I define it in such a way that the result is nice and gauge invariant? What's going on here conceptually is that A lives in a Lie algebra, which tells you about infinitesimal transformations. And exponentiating a Lie algebra makes it into a group element. And are some of you familiar with the relationship between an algebra and a group? So this is now going to live in the group, SU2 as the group. The exponential I should actually put, if these are permission as I define them, I should put an I here. And then the exponential of an anti-permission, I hope I have this right, object is a unitary matrix. No, there's no I. Right? The exponential of permission is unitary. So that's the right definition. The exponential of a Hermitian matrix is unitary. So this is some unitary matrix which lives in the group SU2 of unitary matrices. Unitary.
It should be an I.
It should be an I.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's what I thought the first time. But I was judging by the skeptical looks I was getting. But I think you're right.
Yeah, I think it's an I because there's some tau in the end.
Yes.
Tau is I.
Yeah. Isn't this great that I'm on film? Yeah. But of course, everybody's very forgiving, we hope. Okay. So, and so the question, the idea is that the derivative is associated with an infinitesimal transformation which lives in the algebra. And now what we want to do is define a group element which has to do with making that infinitesimal transformation over a whole curve. And that's what this is defined as. Now, the thing is that if I expand out, there are two ways to define this. One way, and I'm going to explain both of them, one way is to use the power series to define the exponential of a matrix. So in other words, this is equal, I'm going to put the mysterious sign out there. Again, this is equal to 1 plus I times the integral, and I'm just going to just highlight the part of the notation that I want, the integral over gamma of A times sigma. And then there's another term, minus a half from I squared over 2, an integral ds, an integral ds prime. And here I have, actually, will people be happy? Let me just write it this as A of s, which you know is a matrix. So there's a matrix associated to every point on the line here, which is A of S. And here I have integral ds of S, A of S, and A of S prime, and so forth. Okay? They're up to terms with and as many integrals as you like, kind of powers of A at different points. Okay, and the P means order them in order of S. So that you always put to the right the person further along the curve, the matrix further along the curve. And that's what path order means. Whenever you have this bunch of A's that you have to multiply them in the order of the S's of the parameter along the curve where you are. Okay? And that's the definition of this P, which means path order. Okay, and I think Byers's book is a good place for this, to have more discussion of this.
So in some sense, this is a condition also in the equation limits, right? This path. Does this multiple integrals, or can you integrate over always the right intervals, basically?
You can express it in a messy way as limits on the conditions on the limit here. Now, there's another way to define this. I think I won't need anything here, so I'll put it here.
You also want to cover the whole integral range for each one. I mean, there are several different terms if you write it that way. Cover the square.
No, you can only the triangle. Yeah.
Okay. So the other way is to take the path and divide the path up into some large number of segments. So I'll call this gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, etc. Some large number of segments. Each one of segment begins with a tangent vector at that point, which is called, say, gamma dot 2. And each segment in parameter space is a delta S, which is 1 over, since I had S run from 0 to 1, the delta S is 1 over n, where n is the number of segments. And then I can write 1 plus A at the point, well, so I've used a bad notation here. Let me call S0 the first point, S1 the beginning of the second segment, S2 the beginning of the third segment, and so forth. 1 plus S1, gamma dot 1, so that's a vector into a 1 form, this is a matrix. 1 plus A and S2, gamma dot A2, etc. So I just take the infinitesimal exponential, just the 1 plus the matrix, for each little segment, and I multiply them together. And then I take the limit as the number of segments goes to infinity, so that implies that the delta S goes to 0. And this limit gives the same object H of gamma and A. And I definitely leave it as an exercise to show that those two are equal to each other and to show the following important properties. And let me just look at my notes to make sure I write down all the important properties. So the important properties of H are under a gauge transformation. So where delta A is equal to the covariant derivative of, say, mu I, then H of gamma and A, actually, I want to write this differently. I want to say A goes to an A prime, and I'm going to use the exponent. Yes?
There are some odds in the
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. Let me use the exponentiated form of the gauge transformation. So I'm going to imagine I have a group element g at h point in x, which is the exponential of the group element of the Lie algebra element at each point that I'm dealing with. And then A transforms in an elegant way under an exponentiated form of the gauge transformation. It goes to G inverse D plus A times G. The infinitesimal form of that is what we had before. So this is a group or exponentiated gauge transformation. And under such a transformation, you can show that H goes to G inverse at the point gamma of 0 at the beginning of the curve here times H of the curve of A times G at the end of the curve. So that's a very lovely property and a key property. It says that the holonomy transforms, even though a lot of messy stuff is happening in the middle, the holonomy transforms just by the group element at the beginning, by its inverse in the group element at the end. Now, that has a nice implication, which is I can define and the trace. I can consider now gamma closed, and if gamma is now a closed curve, it has still some base point P, which is gamma of 0 and gamma of 1. But I can take now the trace of H of gamma and A, and because of the trace, the G's come around and multiply the G inverses, and this is invariant. And then we give this a name, we call this T of gamma and A, and this is gauge invariant. And this is a very important function which is called the Wilson loop. Sorry, 1L. And another property is that it's reparametrization invariant. That is, if S goes to S prime of S, in, as long as I don't change the limits running from 0 to 1, H goes to H. So it's reparametrization invariant. And finally, a final property, which is a very lovely property, is the following. Supposing, and actually this is such a lovely property, it's going to get its own blackboard. But are there any questions about what we had so far? Well, before we go to that, I'll write something which is obvious. Okay. Well, it's obvious, but it's still worth its own blackboard. Given a base point, some point P, there are many loops, alpha, beta, etc., that leave and end on that base point. And there is actually a group of loops because if I go around alpha and then go around beta, that's a loop. So I can multiply loops together. And if I go around alpha and then go around alpha in the other direction, that's the trivial loop. The trivial loop is the loop that just stays there. So the loops make a group. Okay? Now consider H alpha times H beta. Well, that is, I just multiply, these are each group elements. So in other words, given H of alpha, what is H of alpha? So let me, I'll just go under various names, the loop group. I'll just call it GL. GL is, that's bad. That will get very confusing. L, some people would notate this as LG, which G is a group and L means the loops. Okay. So that's a group. And notice what H does. H really makes a map from the loop of the group, from the group of the loop, sorry, to the group. Okay? Because for every loop, you get a group element. So not only are the loops form a group, what the H's do is they give you a map from the group of the loops just to the group. That those G's mean different things. So let me sort of say it this way. Okay? And this is has all the nice properties. It's a homeomorphism, I think is the right way to say it. Because H of alpha times H of beta multiplying in the group SU2 is the same thing as H of the group, the loops multiply together. And similarly, H of alpha with H of alpha inverse is 1, which is the H of the loop that doesn't go anywhere. Okay, so it's a homeomorphism between the groups. Now that's not the beautiful property I wanted to show you. The beautiful property I wanted to show you is what happens if you have a really little loop. Okay, so supposing, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to blow it up. So we're going to look at that in the microscope. And we're going to go around the curve defined by 2 vectors at the base point P. So I'm going to have a vector V and a vector W. And I'm going to have a little distance epsilon. And I'm going to make a path by going an epsilon along V. I'm just doing this in R2, just in the back, in Rn, just in some coordinate system there. I'm going to go epsilon along V, then epsilon up, then epsilon back, to go around a little square like that. Okay. And let me call that object gamma. That's a little loop. It's a function of V, W, and epsilon. You seen that before?
We're trying to think
that's
a homomorphism or a
homomorphism.
Oh, it's really
great. You're the math guys. You tell me. Okay. Sorry.
I think it's
definitely. Yeah. Actually, I think you're right too. I think you're right, and I apologize. I really do apologize, but I want to show you this. So we're going around a little loop, and the idea is I want to tell you what is H of this little loop. It's a leading order in epsilon. So there's a little square here. And that little square has area epsilon squared. So this is a check. Basically, you write out the definition. And you can, it's easiest to do this at that level, right? 1 plus A, 1 plus A, 1 plus A 4 times. Okay. 1 plus A here, 1 plus A there, 1 plus A there, and 1 plus A there. Okay. If you write that out 4 times and you calculate it, then this is a beautiful little thing. It's 1 plus VA WB epsilon squared times, anybody? The field strength, FABI sigma I, plus order epsilon cubed. Okay. So that's interesting. It means that supposing I have a one-parameter family of loops. Well, let's see if I want to. No, let me not go there yet. This is good enough for the moment. There are nice implications of this. But it means that the Fs tell you something like, so imagine I have a loop. And then I change the loop by a little bit. By, at that point, changing the loop just by a little bit with a vector V. And this vector here is now gamma dot, the tangent vector of the loop, let's say at the point P. Okay. So it means that the change. So now I consider the difference between, let me keep that the base point, taking the H around there and taking the H around that little deformed loop. Okay. And what that means is the delta of H under this little change, is equal to, now B is now gamma dot A, B, B, F, A, B, I, sigma I, times H, because it does, because this is just the infinitesimal change, times the little epsilon squared. So the F measures the small, if you change the loop a little bit, the F measures the change. Yeah?
What does it mean to make a small change when you don't have a metric?
Thank you for answering, for asking that question. What would you like to answer?
Okay,
so what it means is that I've been working here under the implicit assumption that I was working on, sorry, Rn. I said that at some point, so that I'm using a metric. I'm using implicitly that there is that there is a measure of. I'm actually not really using all the information in the metric. I'm just saying that I can measure the area of that of any little thing that I want. Okay. So if you see this. From this, and this is a check, and it's not very hard. Again, if you write this as 1 plus A, etc., four times, this just comes out. So it's not very hard to get this. In fact, it's not hard to get the next terms or the terms after that, in case you really want them. Okay. And they are used. But what's useful about this is supposing that, remember, I'm in a case where lambda, this parameter, is zero. So on the theory, now I come back to the theory I'm interested in. On the theory, f is zero. So there's a consequence of this, which is the following. When f is zero, then supposing I have two curves, gamma and alpha, which where gamma is homotopic to alpha. And when I refer to curves and I use that symbol, I mean homotopic. Homotopic. Okay. Which means that you can smoothly slide gamma to alpha. Okay. So when f equals zero, under a small change, H doesn't change. So it's not going to change if you accumulate a lot of small changes. So when F equals zero, when gamma and alpha are homotopic, okay, and let's give them a common base point here so that I know what I mean. Okay. They have a common base point, but they're otherwise all homotopic. H of gamma is equal to H of alpha.
Sorry, are you assuming that A and B are space like this?
Doesn't matter. This is I'm just doing you on a manifold.
Right.
So if I'm on a manifold where f is zero. If I'm on a manifold where f is zero, this is a mathematical property, and I have two curves which have the same base point but are homotopic, then h of gamma is h of alpha. Which means that actually H, so now I define, and I'll just define this and stop. There is, given that the loops in a manifold make a group, I do want to write this somewhere, so I'm looking for fresh blackboard, which I guess will be under here. Okay. We say two curves, I already said this, gamma and alpha are homotopic, sharing a base point, two base curves, if they can be slid to each other. Okay. There then is the notion of homotopy classes. So a homotopy class is the whole class of curves which are homotopic to a given curve. And that is often denoted like this. Okay. Again, fixing a base point. So, for example, if I'm on the torus, then one homotopy class are curves that just go and come back. Another homotopy class are curves that go around once. Because any curve that goes around once from that wall to that wall, starting at this base point and coming back, is in a single homotopy class. Another homotopy class is curves that, let me just make this into a cylinder so you can see what I'm talking about. So there's that homotopy class that goes around once, and then there's another homotopy class that goes around twice, and so forth. Because you can't smoothly deform a curve that goes around twice around the cylinder from one that goes around once. Okay? So,
but usually in homotopy classes, you don't actually need to have the same base point. Exactly.
You don't, but I am keeping it for the moment. I am keeping a base point for a reason, okay? Which I'm about to say. Okay. Now, remember the H's were a mapping from the curves to the group. But if they have the same value on every member of a homotopy class, okay, then H is actually a function of a homotopy class. This is all when F equals zero. Then H is a function of the homotopy class. In other words, I start here, I go around once, and no matter how I meander, all the curves where H starts at that base point goes around once and comes back are in the same homotopy class. So H is a function of the homotopy classes. Moreover, the homotopy classes themselves form a group. And it's rather trivial, but it should be said. The class of alpha times the class of beta is the class of alpha combined with beta. So for example, if I multiply the homotopy class of going around the cylinder once with itself, I get the homotopy class of going twice around the cylinder. Okay. So the homotopy classes also form a group. And so finally, H, and that's called, that group has a name, that is called pi 1 of the manifold. Now, I'm keeping a base point, so I'm going to put a little p there to denote the base point. It doesn't actually depend on the base point, but I'm keeping the base point for the moment. Okay. And then the H is the map from pi 1, and this is why I keep the base point, to the group, which in our case is SU2. And again, it's a homomorphism.
Is a loop homotopic to its inverse?
No. So there's a direction. Yeah, I'm not yet dropping the base point. The reason why I'm not dropping the base point is that if I move the base point around, the H changes.
It's zero.
Well, but the subtlety here is, let me consider that. But let me actually think. If I move the base point, so here's P and here's Q, okay, then just watch, okay? H starting and ending in Q is the same thing as starting at Q, going back to P, going around to P, and then going from P to Q. Okay. So H based at P is the same thing as H based at Q times H on the segment P goes to Q times H on the segment Q goes to P. In other words, if I start at P and go all the way around to P, that's the same thing as starting at P and going to Q, then going all the way around, and then going back from Q to P. Okay? This is a group element. This is some group element. This is the inverse of that group element. So it's behaving like a gauge transformation when I change the base point. But it still changes when I change the base point. And therefore, if I want to make this statement, I need to mention the base point. But I hope the statement is clear. Okay. Now, if I go to the t's, which are the traces of the h, then the base point, this is base point independent. Because the trace will cancel this out. So if I take the Wilson loop, it doesn't depend on the base point. But then I no longer have a beautiful mapping from the pi 1 to the group, because the t's don't live in the group. They're just complex numbers. They live in the traces, or there's some fancy name for that. They live in the characters of the group. Okay. So this is why I keep the base point here. Okay. Yeah.
I wonder how useful is this property, because it works only for vanishing curvature. Right? I mean, like for electrodynamics and across the space, it wouldn't work like that.
Yes, it's. I agree with that, but there happen to be theories of interest where the F's are zero.
Yeah.
It's basically like 2 plus on gravity.
Well,
yes.
Okay. So the statement is that some of the observables in 2 plus 1 gravity on an arbitrary manifold are the H's for each homotopy class of the manifold. So if I can refer to this function as H of pi 1 of the manifold, those are the observables. Or I can trace them, and then I can have t of pi 1. So for every element of pi 1, there's a number which is the trace of the holonomy around any element of that pi 1. And those are the observables.
Yeah, but we have already basically all the constructors. So this funny thing here is that we can basically classify them.
Yes.
We can distinguish them.
Yes. Yeah.
There's something in the London. So when you go around from P around like that, that must be exactly the same thing from going from Q around. So
sure.
Why isn't H of P just equal to H of Q?
No, it's not. Taking the path order integral from here back to here is not equal to taking the path order integral from here back to here.
Isn't that the same thing?
No.
Because of the ordering. The ordering matters.
Okay. Any other questions?
So I don't know if you have a cone or something like that, something which is, which has a funny way of loops.
If you have a cone, you mean I have a point taking a cylinder. A cone is the same as a cylinder.
Cone is something which they're basically curvature in one point.
Yes.
And then you have loops which are outside the apex, which have the apex. So basically this fractional gene is done.
Yes, so the question that you're asking, and there may be people who want me to take a break, but I'll address it and then we'll see how tired we are, is supposing I have a two-manifold, okay, and on the two-manifold I have the following, that I have a point y such that f of x I is delta 2 of x and y, and since I have something in the Lie algebra here, I'll call it qi. So it's characterized by a little Lie algebra element at this point here. Okay? So supposing that I have this. Okay, so f is 0 everywhere except for a point. Okay? Well, let me consider a closed loop gamma around there. Okay. And I'd like to know what is h, or what is, let's say, I want to know what is t of gamma. That's observable. Okay. Well, we know that everywhere where f is 0, it doesn't depend. I can move the curve around everywhere where f is 0. So I can make, it's going to have the same value on a really tiny curve. This is a heuristic argument. This argument can be made better.
Is that point part of the manifold, or is it taken out? Because f should be equal to 0, right?
It's a point in the manifold, but it's a point where f is not 0.
Okay, so is that allowed? I mean,
I haven't explained. Okay, it's not allowed, but supposing I had some other stuff in the theory, I might have something like this. Quote a particle, and this is in fact how particles show up. Okay? So I want to know what that is. Well, I can make it a really tiny curve. Okay, actually, let me talk about h. It'd be easier for me to talk about h, as we'll see in a moment. So I take a point really close, and I take a really small curve around there. Okay? Well, since the curve is very small, I can use this infinitesimal. Okay. And what this really means, if I use the infinitesimal, is that h is like 1. So let's say there's a region R. H is like 1 plus the integral over R of f. This is, if I imagine building up using calculus a bunch of little small regions, is the integral of f on R I, and I'll just leave it there as a Lie algebra element. And this is like 1 plus, now the integral of f is the integral over delta function. This is 1 times the q. So this is just 1 plus qi. Okay. Now, in fact, it's more work to show that h in such a situation is actually the exponential of q as a group element. That all the higher order terms look nicely. So that's what happens in that case. Okay. Let's take a 15-minute break and save up some questions.